no allergenic foods or no nuts and dairy at a party where there are no nut and dairy allergic children identified. That doesn't make sense to me at all.
Welcome to Ditch the Lab Coat with Dr. Mark Bonta, a podcast that examines health issues with a critical eye grounded in scientific skepticism.
Disclaimer. The Ditch the Lab Coat podcast is exclusively meant for general informational purposes and should not be regarded as a substitute for professional medical services, including medicine or nursing. It does not create a doctor-patient relationship, and any reliance on the information provided in the podcast or linked materials is at the user's own risk. The content is not intended to replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. The expressed opinions belong solely to the host and guests, and they do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the hospitals, clinics, universities, or any other organization associated with the host or guests.
You know, it's funny, when I applied to medical school as somebody who didn't come from a family of medical doctors, I really had a skewed view of what medical training would look like. And frankly, it's what a lot of people out there believe it to be, is what you see on TV. Now, medical school is not a sexy and glamorous thing. It's actually busy, it's tiring, it's exhausting, it's stressful. It's a lot of fun, right? It's a great and rewarding career. But one of the biggest stresses associated with completing medical school is deciding what you're going to do next. So in Canada, we complete 4 years of medical education, which is when you get your medical degree or medical doctorate, the MD. And at the end of that, we choose a residency. And there are a whole host of different careers that we can choose. You know, you can have the black bag and be the primary care provider, the family physician, caring for people longitudinally, caring for the entire family, the parents, the children, at all stages of life, delivering babies. Family medicine is a very rewarding career and one that our country needs more people to be doing right now. It's in crisis. People don't have access to primary care providers, but it's a great job and one that some people choose to do at the end of their training. Other people choose to be eye surgeons, you know, ophthalmologists, and ranging from front of the eye issues like cataracts to back of the eye issues in the retina. Some people choose to be otolaryngologists, right? Specialists of the ear, nose, and throat. Other people want to be critical care doctors or straight up emergency medicine doctors. Now, for what I do, which is a specialist in general internal medicine, to try to make sense of that when I'm at a party and people ask me what I do, I basically explain it as when you come to hospital and you go to the emergency department, the emergency doctors try to fix you, right? They try to put a cast on you to make you better and have you go home. They diagnose your earache, your sore throat, your cough, and they give you a prescription and you go home and continue that. But some people are too sick to go home. And if they're too sick to go home, they either get admitted to a surgeon, right? They're bowels exploded or they have a perforated appendix and they need to be admitted to hospital and get surgery, or they get admitted for other issues that are treated with pills. And if you're admitted for other issues and are treated with pills, you'll probably see a specialist in internal medicine. And as somebody who's been involved in the selection of residents, right? So at the end of medical school, when you have to choose your residency career, you apply to these different prospective careers and specialties, and you go through an interview process. And one of the common themes that a lot of people who love what I do, which is internal medicine, is a love for the pathophysiology. So why does somebody have chest pain when they have a heart attack? Why do some people need to take puffers or bronchodilators because their airways get tight and wheezy when they're exposed to certain things? What's going on with cancer? Right? At the cellular level, how do all these new treatments, chemotherapies, immune therapies work? What are the risk profiles and side effects? So it's a really deep understanding of the why. One particular field within internal medicine that fascinates me and is well above my head is that of allergy and immunology. What a fascinating system. Why some people have allergic reactions, why some people develop autoimmune diseases as they age, what's going on with vaccines, how do they work, and what are the side effects. In one of my side jobs that I do on top of podcasting, doctoring, parenting, husbanding, is work with the federal government on vaccine injury and looking at whether or not vaccines can cause an autoimmune or immune response that can cause injury. One of the people that I work with is brilliant. She's well-spoken. She's an expert in allergy and immunology. She has a different story than most doctors. Dr. Magda Berger is an allergist and immunologist, and she's joining me in the studio today. She was an assistant professor at Dalhousie University through the Department of Internal Medicine when she worked clinically out in Moncton, New Brunswick, which is out in the Maritimes in the east coast of Canada. But she closed her clinical practice 3 years ago in order to spend more time with her children. But she remains engaged in the allergy and immunology world through her work in this federal vaccine injury program, but also through her passion and her interest in the why and the pathophysiology. And it really comes across in our conversation today. She's actually spent the last 5 years working as a co-founder and director of Eastgate Academy, which is a primary year school in the Maritimes, which is growing into a full kindergarten to year 12 school. And that's where all of her children attend. She's also a certified yoga instructor. So she has a host of non-medical interests, and her roles in the educational world of our children is quite relevant to our conversation today, which predominantly focuses on the first half of that job title of allergist and immunologist. We get right into allergies today. She wants to share one common misconception about her career, which is that allergists and immunologists fully understand the immune system and that the system is a clear-cut, well-mapped-out algorithmic model that functions in an orderly way. There are a ton of unknowns in the field of allergy and immunology. And although experts like Magda do their best to make sense of this, there are still a lot of head scratchers out there. There's still a lot of expert consensus. And what she does today is brings a very complex world into the podcast studio today and breaks it down in a way that all of us can understand. And what we talk about today particularly applies to people who have young children, people who are parents, people who are trying to navigate large group events, people who are trying to navigate some of the issues around food allergies in the school environment. And we also cover some practical tips on what to do if you're around somebody who you think is having an anaphylactic allergic reaction. So with that being said, let's get right into the episode today. It's a great and engaging conversation, a wonderful guest to have. Without further ado, Dr. Magda Berger. Magda, I was invited to a kids' party, right? I have four kids, all little. You have three kids, mostly little. And I was told to bring a snack, a dessert, but I was told the snack should be nut-free and dairy-free. But none of the kids in the group had a history of anaphylaxis to nuts or dairy. What's up with that?
Wow. Well, I mean, that's weird. So bringing nut-free and dairy-free, I understand if you've got a nut-free and dairy-free anaphylaxis child in the party, so they're trying to be protective, but to just blanket statement say no allergenic foods or no nuts and dairy at a party where there are no nut and dairy allergic children identified, that doesn't make sense to me at all. This question comes up a lot, right? Like this question comes up a lot with kids' birthday parties in schools or social functions or any extracurricular activities. Everybody seems to have different kind of like food restrictions or blanket statements about don't bring this, that, or the other thing. I was at a gymnastics studio the other day and it's, you know, no red peppers allowed, please. Nobody pack red peppers here. And that's pervasive sort of everywhere. And I guess the questions that are important to ask are, is there anybody here who actually has anaphylaxis to that item? Like that they have known anaphylaxis? If so, I would say that depending on the scenario, yeah, it makes sense to avoid it. If it's a birthday party, everybody's going to be running around sharing food. There's young children. They're not going to be washing their hands. They're not going to be cleaning up after themselves. They're going to be spreading peanuts and dairy. Of course, restrict it. But if there is nobody like that at the party or there's no reason to do so, then no, it doesn't make sense. There's no logic behind that at all. There was a great paper published a few years ago. Dr. Susan Wasserman was on it, and she's done a lot of research on allergies in schools and whether the policies have sort of helped us or hurt us. And this has been echoed in other papers as well, where avoiding allergenic foods in schools and having blanket statements about don't bring it here hasn't actually done much at all with regards to decreasing the rates of anaphylaxis in schools or emergency room presentations or fatalities for that matter. So there doesn't seem to be a good reason to blanket avoid. There is a lot of evidence to support case-specific risk mitigation, but not blanket avoidance.
And I think, like, as a parent, I struggle and, you know, have had friends who have had kids who have had allergies, and I don't want to be responsible for harming someone's child. And I also have to balance that with practical, realistic decision-making. You know, when you describe kids running around at a party, you know, the whole viral transmission thing comes to mind, and kids are going to be kids. And I think it's important to define what anaphylaxis is, right? Because not every kid who has had an insensitivity or even a reaction. And I think about my father-in-law who believes he's allergic to shellfish, and it's probably he just ate crappy shrimp at a all-inclusive hotel buffet, right? But he doesn't have anaphylaxis to shellfish, but that's become his narrative. And so if you're a parent of a child with a nut allergy, let's focus on nut allergies, how do you know if that child's actually had anaphylaxis?
Well, I mean, you bring up a good point. And not everybody has access to an allergist or to have the testing done to confirm whether or not they do have an allergy. I'm separating peanuts and tree nuts here because they're different. But if you don't know and you have that narrative of my child is allergic, they had this experience and they're allergic, and you don't have access to somebody to verify that or not for you, then that's terrifying, right? Of course, that's terrifying. You're going to avoid on instinct. You're going to ask everybody else to avoid to protect your child because of course you are, right? Like that's the scariest thing to happen to somebody. And when you hear allergy to food, parents, especially parents with young children who haven't had the opportunity to meet with an allergist, are going to think, what's the worst case scenario here? Well, the worst case scenario is there might be a fatality. You know, my child could be severely hurt, injured, or end up in the emergency room, or worst case scenario, die from exposure to this allergy. That's the belief. That's the automatic place your head goes. So if you have no way to verify that, to see an allergist, to get the skin testing, the blood testing, or the challenge to confirm that, then that's the statement you're going to be carrying around with you. And yes, I'll separate adults from children here because for children, you know, it's the parents who are responsible for their care there. It becomes very frightening. So yes, you want to confirm whether or not it was an allergy first and foremost. So to distinguish an intolerance from a food allergy, super, super critically important. You want that information. You need that information. You need that information for your child going forward in the future. Do they need to avoid? Do they need to be terrified? Do they need to carry an epinephrine auto-injector? Do they need to have a medical alert bracelet? Like these things matter, and you want to be certain that they do have an anaphylactic potential to an allergenic food. If it is an intolerance, a preference, I don't like it, I just don't like the taste of it. Fine. You can identify that amongst your friends and cohorts and say, my child doesn't like this food. That's different. But to be a true allergy, from an allergist perspective, allergy means there's a risk of anaphylaxis. That means you should be carrying an EpiPen and have a medical alert. And people need to be aware of how to manage that. So you want to get that confirmed.
So I live in a rural town. We don't have an allergist and immunologist. And so if I'm a parent and, you know, there's a crisis of primary care too in Canada, so limited access to family physicians. So a lot of people might not have access to a regulated healthcare professional. And you're at a party or you're giving your kid peanut butter and toast. When do you say this looks like anaphylaxis versus this looks like a, you know, mild intolerance or a non-anaphylactic reaction? And is there a difference? Like, can you have a non-anaphylactic reaction to peanut butter, or is it all or none, anaphylaxis or nothing?
Well, the way I talk about anaphylaxis with my adult patients, because I'll put this out there, I in clinical practice seeing only adults, but the way I describe an allergy to food is it's sort of like a pregnancy. You're not like a little bit, you are or you aren't. You're allergic or you're not allergic. It's an all-in or not all-in. If you are allergic, there's always the potential for anaphylaxis. It doesn't mean that with every exposure you're going to have anaphylaxis, but you either are at risk of anaphylaxis or you are not at risk for anaphylaxis. So from an allergist perspective, it's a little bit black and white that way, like you are or you are not allergic. So that needs to be defined. And how is that defined? That basically is whether or not you have circulating IgEs. And how do you detect that? There's one of two ways. You do that with skin testing or with a blood test. So fair enough, if you don't have access to an allergist, there are some family physicians who are comfortable verifying that as well. There are some, I see that a lot here in New Brunswick because we don't have specialists in allergy and immunology here that are accessible. So there are clinics that pop up and certain family physicians feel comfortable doing the skin testing or ordering the serum IgEs to verify whether or not there is that. That's step one. Step two is you would want to do a food challenge. And that is done in an allergist's office where you confirm that in fact the story sounds like there's possible anaphylaxis. The skin test and or blood test confirm that risk is there, and then you can proceed with the challenge to verify it if there's still some question, because maybe it wasn't like a slam dunk. Now, if you've got a child who presented with their first presentation with anaphylaxis, skin test or blood test was positive, you're not giving them that food to confirm it, right? Like, that's enough. But if there is a questionable story with a positive blood test and skin test, then you would go on to do a food challenge to confirm that. And you need that information, even though it's terrifying. You want that information as a parent. You want that done in a controlled setting because you want to know how cautious do you need to be moving forward.
So what looks like anaphylaxis? You know, you've talked about circulating immune globulins and anaphylaxis. Yep. You know, as healthcare providers, I can recognize that when I'm working in the hospital or in the critical care environment. But as a parent, is it your lips are swollen, you get itchy? Like,
right. It's more than one system or shock in one system. So basically, the skin system would be lips swelling or hives, like diffuse hives. You want to be careful. Sometimes children will have with contact, like if they smear some peanut butter on their arm, they'll get hives on that section. So you want to see them that they've ingested it and then they've developed hives because of that. So hives are angioedema, which is the swelling, like the big swelling of the lips or the big swelling of the tongue or eye, or they puff up. It looks not normal. That's the skin findings. Respiratory findings. So they may start coughing or wheezing or tightness in the chest, difficulty breathing. The GI stuff would be like gut cramps or nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. And sometimes in little kids, they just look a little bit dazed and confused and sleepy and not themselves. So those are all the major systems that would be showing signs of anaphylaxis. So if you see a child, or if your child has ingested a food and then they break out in hives or they start coughing or their tongue is swelling, that is anaphylaxis.
And so at that point, you know, you get medical attention. And if you have an EpiPen in the house, you would want to administer that, I guess. And then well, you go through some of these testing to confirm the diagnosis, but you mentioned a food challenge. So you'd straight up bring your kid to a clinic and have them eat the foods that you think they're allergic to and watch what happens?
That happens if the story is not clear, right? So it's like if someone, say, for example, what you'll see is a child ate a granola bar and the granola bar has lots of nuts and seeds and all sorts of things in it. And then they had a reaction and you really don't know what they reacted to. So you can do the skin test and blood test to test for the different components of the bar. And then you might want to verify that with the challenge afterwards. So say you get a skin test that shows multiple things, seeds and nuts and peanuts and all sorts of different things. Well, you don't want to just blanket statement say, avoid all of that. You want to know for sure which one is it that caused you that problem. Because skin testing, it's interesting, right? People think that just getting the skin test or just getting the blood test and like, oh, look, there's serum IgE. That's anaphylaxis for sure. That's not true. You know, we used to say, if I take 100 people off the street and skin test them, 50% of them are going to be positive to something. That doesn't mean that they're allergic. It just means that they've got a positive skin test. You need to verify that. So you need that history to work alongside your test to prove it. But if you have a history where there are multiple things ingested, and then you have a skin test that shows multiple positives, well, now you have to go through those steps of verifying what was it that caused the problem. And you want to do that because you don't want to say blanket, avoid everything. That's going to come with other problems for the child. And actually, there's been good evidence to suggest that avoiding certain highly allergenic foods, if you are not allergic, might even predispose you to developing a problem with that food down the road. So you don't want to avoid foods. I understand that the knee-jerk reaction, well, it's just safer to stay away from everything allergenic, but it actually could potentially work against you in the future. You don't want that. You want to verify it. So if you have a lot of positive skin tests and a questionable food item because multiple things were consumed, then you're going to want to go through the steps of doing a food challenge to each one of those components until you know which one it was that did that to you.
So what's the deal with peanuts? You separated peanuts from tree nuts.
Yeah.
Why are peanuts so bad?
Oh, well, why? That's the million-dollar question, the why. But they're legumes, so they're different. This is funny. Like with allergy, I can go through these algorithms. I can tell people, this is what we need to do, and this is the next step, and here's what we do if A and B, that this is... But then that question, but why did this happen to me? But why do I have this? But why is it that food? I don't know how to answer that. Nobody knows how to answer that. So it's just me. It's a really solid question. Why are peanuts so bad? I don't know. They are. There's some discussion or some theories around that suggesting that it's the more common the food is, that is more likely to be a highly allergenic food. So foods that we commonly eat are more commonly on the list of highly allergenic foods. You'll see different common allergens in different countries depending on what people are consuming. So, but that doesn't really answer the question as to why. It just means that your immune system has for some reason turned itself on against this item. And do we mostly eat peanuts as children? No, I would say no, not for the last 10, 20 years, actually, because of the fear of peanut allergy. So I'm not really sure why that one specifically, but I will say that peanuts and tree nuts are very different, and peanuts fall into the legume family. And so they're not related. So that is something that's important for parents to distinguish, because saying peanut and tree nut avoidance is very different than saying just peanut or just tree nut. There's whole swaths of food that you are restricting by just pan labeling an allergy to all of them.
So all nuts are not the same, but a tree nut, no. Like I guess a cashew is a tree nut?
A cashew is a tree nut. Yeah. Cashews, walnuts, pistachios, almonds, basically everything other than peanut is a tree nut.
But if you're allergic to one tree nut, are you allergic to all of them or is it just that one tree nut?
Mark, solid question. So lots of cross-reactivity. There's a lot of cross-reactivity. Not necessarily, though, are you allergic to all tree nuts if you're allergic to one tree nut. So again, this is why it would be lovely for everybody to have access to an allergist, because no, some people are allergic to only some or only one tree nut, but can still consume the others. There is a risk of cross-reactivity. There is a risk of eventually developing an allergy to the other tree nuts. However, there's also an argument to be made that perhaps it's protective to continue eating things that you are tolerant of to retain that tolerance, right? I mean, if you look at what we're doing with the oral immunotherapy in a different category. So these are kids who are known allergic to a specific food item, and they're getting a graded reintroduction of that food to induce tolerance. Part of that protocol, part of what's required, is maintaining regular consumption of that food once a tolerance level is achieved to keep that tolerance. So there is an argument to be made that if you are not allergic to all tree nuts, that the ones that you are not allergic to, you maintain some consumption of them regularly so that you are protected against developing an allergy for them in the future. It's not a guarantee, but these are the non-black and white areas of allergy.
So a lot to unpackage. And I think about my wife, who's the brains behind our operation, and she's an emergency medicine nurse. And with four kids, you know, we've had different approaches to all of them. And I like to think that we've kind of figured it out by kid four. But one of the things that she started doing with kids three and kid four are early introduction to peanuts and eggs and getting these things on their hands and having the baby eat some peanuts at 9 months, at 12 months. And it sounds like that's in keeping with this hypothesis, which is the sooner you're exposed to something, the better. And the more that you're consistently exposed, the less likely you are to develop an anaphylactic or severe reaction to something. Is there science behind that, or is it just a trend?
Yes. No, there is science behind that, but I will say you commented about putting them on hands and getting them to eat. So you don't actually want to introduce a food through the skin. So smearing foods on baby's skin is not necessarily a good approach to introduction. And yes, early introduction of highly allergenic foods, generally speaking, is a good idea, but huge but, if you have an atopic child, and someone who is predisposed to allergies, or a child with eczema, or a child with asthma, they are already predisposed to developing an allergenic profile or potentially more allergies in addition to having those other atopic conditions. So for those, you proceed with caution. For all children, for food introduction, it's one food at a time. And especially when it's highly allergenic foods, you're introducing one food at a time because you don't want to have that muddy picture where a reaction forms and there's been three new things introduced, right? But yes, you want to do it carefully. And it's not necessarily that all children benefit from introduction of all allergens super early. If they're atopic, it might not be great. And if you're not going to be maintaining it regularly in your diet, you're also potentially not doing them any favors, right? It means it's cool that you introduce shrimp to, you know, your 1-year-old or 18-month-old, but if you're not going to eat shrimp again until they're 8 or they hate it, you know, like, why? What was the purpose of that? You're not necessarily helping create tolerance.
And shrimp are kind of gross. They're like bugs of the sea. As a medical professional who trains residents and students in Canada, one of the things that I really like about the job is I get to work with people from all throughout the globe. I've worked with and supervised a lot of international medical graduates, so people coming from all far reaches of the globe. And something I've heard consistently, and I actually just heard this a week ago from someone of South Asian descent, and in general, people from Southeast Asia, India, have commented a few times when I've ordered food for the team, right? Because we often have team lunches and team dinners together with the medical learners. I always ask about any allergies. And I've had a few people from this part of the world say, we're from India, Thailand, Philippines. We don't have allergies there. We're not like you people in Canada. And so I've actually heard that enough that I start to wonder, is there a difference globally? Like, are allergies and this whole nut-free, dairy-free approach to kids' birthday parties, is that a North American thing? And is it based in any evidence or epidemiology?
Oh, well, so good question. I mean, allergies do exist across the globe. Yes. The list of the highly allergenic foods that you see in the westernized world is that it is distinct from allergies that you're going to see in other parts of the globe. And again, the theories abound as to why. Is it exposure? Is it that we're more atopic? Is there the hygiene hypothesis has been thrown around? Is that potentially why we're all so much more allergic and atopic than our counterparts in other countries? And the jury's still out on that. That is hotly debated as to why that is. And yes, I've heard that too. And it's very interesting to see how differently it's approached in different countries. There is something about the Western world and our, I don't know if you're going to say lifestyle, diet, approach, too short a time period to say genetics, because really the rise in allergies and atopic diseases has been a bit of an exponential rise over the last 50 plus years. That's not accounted for by anything that's genetic. So, but there are differences. And I'm not going to say they don't have them, because they absolutely do have allergies and anaphylaxis in all parts of the world. But we do have a higher rise in the Western. And why is at every conference you attend discussed, and we feel like maybe this is the reason, maybe it is X, Y, or Z lifestyle or environmental factor, but nothing has been confirmed as to why that is yet. There's a lot of theories, but it's not proven.
So the hygiene hypothesis, and what I understand about this, I'm not an allergist or immunologist, is you eat food if it falls on the ground.
No. No. Great, though. But children do that. All over the world. That's not a uniquely Western world phenomenon or a non-Western world phenomenon. Hygiene hypothesis has to do with the belief, or not the belief, I shouldn't say it's a belief, because there's science rooted behind it. So IgE, the circulating antibody that I was talking about in reference to what creates this allergic profile, its utility is often seen in eliminating parasites and parasitic diseases. So one of these theories was that because IgE doesn't have much of a job anymore in these hyper-clean Lysol era Western world, wash everything, sanitize everything, clean everything, we're not exposed to so many germs and parasites as our ancestors were. As a result, this IgE has gone haywire and is now creating work for itself by identifying allergens in benign food products. So that's sort of a very loose interpretation of the hygiene hypothesis, basically saying because we are so clean and our immune system is so underactive, these cells in our body that were responsible for protecting us against more commonly prevalent parasitic infections are no longer needing to do so. And so now they've become hyperactive against food. So that isn't completely true. They've done studies on eliminating parasite infections, and I can't quote all of these studies, but I recall reading them that they've tried to do this. They've tried to control for this to say, all right, well, if we take groups of children that have eliminated all parasitic infections in non-industrialized nations and compare them to those who are just allowed to keep their infections, I suppose. Is there any difference in A2P? And that hasn't really panned out. So we haven't been able to control, I think, for enough factors to validate or refute that theory. So it remains a theory. I think everything plays a part in it, but we don't have the one solid unifying explanation to say, this is what it is. You know, it's white sugar, or it's our wheat products, or it's that we use this chemical, or like, we don't have that to blame it on.
I like the story of our body's not busy fighting parasites, so it needs something to occupy its time. But personally, I would rather have an allergy than a parasite. Like, what about you?
Yeah, I don't know, Mark. I mean, parasites can be eradicated, right? And like for allergies, depending on when you get them, you may or may not be able to be desensitized. You may or may not be able to induce tolerance. You might be left with it for the rest of your life. So I don't know. I guess it depends on how bad the parasite is. I would need more information before making a decision on that one.
That's fair. Like, I wouldn't want a parasite in my brain, but I guess like I've had that swimmer's itch, you know, where you jump into the water and you get all those parasites on your skin. So I've had that, and that was a bad 2 days, but like, yeah, I wouldn't mind that.
Not a lifetime of epi. Exactly.
Now, kind of, we talked about immune globulin IgE and nut allergies and anaphylaxis. But when I started off our conversation, I talked about the lumping of allergies and nut allergies and food allergies with dairy allergies. And when I think about dairy allergies, I generally think about people who are lactose intolerant, right? And many of us have some degree of lactose intolerance, right? The ability to digest this. And if I don't take my lactate, right, which is the enzyme to help you digest lactose, I'll get gassy and I'll get queasy. So I'll eat that ice cream, but I got to take my lactate. Now, that sounds like more of an uncomfortable side effect to taking in dairy, and very different from anaphylaxis. But in terms of lactose and dairy allergies, can you have anaphylaxis to dairy?
Yes, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. And that is actually quite a dangerous one, because to your point, it's not as commonly feared as peanut and tree nut, right? So, and it's perhaps maybe not as well understood to your point, right? People will assume that it's more of an intolerance than it is, but you can absolutely be anaphylactic to dairy. And it's quite a scary one, because a lot of foods and a lot of prepackaged foods have dairy powder. So even think about things like Cheetos, Goldfish crackers for kids, right? These are all things that have dairy powder on them. So you do have to be mindful of that. And dairy allergy does result in, there have been fatalities. You absolutely can have anaphylaxis. It is one that you do need to be very mindful of and careful with if you have a child with, or if you have a classmate or somebody on the same team with it. Like, that is one to be aware of for sure. As for lactose intolerance, I mean, that's very, very common. And I know this is maybe not like a pleasant way to think about it, but I'll say it anyways. No species on earth continues to consume breast milk beyond infancy. And other than humans, nobody else is consuming breast milk from another animal. So it makes sense that our bodies are not designed to tolerate dairy lifelong. So lactose intolerance is extremely common, much more common than we even care to acknowledge, wish to acknowledge, or want to talk about, but it's not normal for us to be able to digest milk throughout our entire adult lives.
It's interesting that you say that, because I'm not a milk guy. Like, I actually think it's kind of weird, this whole, the dairy industry and the dairy campaign to like, keep drinking milk, it's good for your bones. You know, milk has a lot of fat, it's coming from another animal. You know, you look at chocolate milk, tons of salt in there. So I don't think it's a great thing. But when you talked about lactose allergies or milk or dairy allergies, if babies are drinking mother's milk, has a baby ever been allergic to breast milk? Like, can that happen?
Yes. Yeah, it can
happen. That's crazy.
It can happen. Yeah, it is. It's super hard, right? And it's super hard. And then you have to be very careful with what kind of formula you're giving the baby. It has happened. It does happen. It is extremely hard, adding to an already stressful perinatal period. And if you're able to breastfeed and wanting to breastfeed, kind of devastating for the mom.
But how common is this? Is this something very rare?
No, I wouldn't. Everything in my world is kind of common for an allergist, but very rare for the general population, right? So no, not common. I mean, less than 1%, right? Like, these are small numbers of people who are affected. And again, you're going to see it more not exclusively, but you're going to see it more in atopic. So atopic individuals, strong atopic family history, or an atopic infant, right? And again, the question as to why, I don't know. There is a lot of really interesting research being done on, and I'm not an expert in this, I will give that before I speak to it. But as a mom, I certainly researched this in my pregnancies when I was going through my allergy fellowship, every little piece of information I could gather. It's like, how do I immediately apply this to my fetus? You know, there are interesting theories about, and now this vitamin D exposure certainly has been, that's not even a theory, that's just proven, like vitamin D deficiency during pregnancy can promote atopic development and atopic tendencies in a child. So vitamin D is a big one, and everybody in North America is deficient, basically. So that's a big thing. They were talking about exposures to farm animals when you're pregnant and exposures to different allergenic environments when you're pregnant, that perhaps that helps kind of skew the likelihood that your baby's going to be born with atopic conditions. But not enough of this is a slam dunk to make anybody suggest that all mothers should do this, or all mothers should eat highly allergenic foods when they're pregnant. All mothers should visit a farm. All mothers should sit out in the sun, get vitamin D, which, you know, again, no, from a skin cancer perspective, but these are all theories. Atopic babies are at higher risk for it, but yeah, it has been described. The breast milk allergies or lactose, it's hard. And sometimes you can get away with changing mom's diet. Sometimes for children who have a hard time with breast milk, it's something that the mom is consuming, that trace amounts of protein are getting through the breast milk that the baby's intolerant to. So you can maybe get around it by doing restrictive diets for the mom. But other times you can't even do that and you're left with formula.
And so atopy, like that term atopic, I always think about the kid who gets itchy rashes and is sensitive to foods and skin creams and that kind of stuff. Maybe asthma falls in there. Is there a universal definition for atopy, or is atopy just something to kind of blanket term describe people who have like more sensitive allergic systems, but don't straight up get anaphylaxis?
Well, and they might get anaphylaxis actually. So atopy is basically a skewing towards that Th2 pathway, to be medical mumbo jumbo about it, but it is that predisposition towards developing allergic diseases. So when we do an atopic history, the questions are eczema, asthma, allergies. And allergies falls under food allergies, environmental allergies. So for an adult, drug allergies, other types of allergies for sure, venom allergies, etc. But really, you're asking about that allergic predisposition makes a person atopic. So usually when you have one, you're at higher risk of developing another one. So if you've got eczema, you're higher risk for developing asthma and food allergies. If you have allergic asthma, you're higher risk for developing eczema and food allergies as well. And they all go together, the three of them.
And so when you talk about atopy and someone who's predisposed to allergies, and we talked about dairy allergies and lactose intolerance, one of the things that you commented on with dairy allergies was that it's ubiquitous, right? You can find it in goldfish, you know, not the fish in the pond, but the actual snacks that kids eat all the time. But is all dairy the same? Like when I think about someone having a dairy allergy, right away my mind thinks about someone who can't drink milk. But can they get an anaphylactic reaction to ice cream, to goldfish? Like, is it all milk products are the same, or is it certain things have higher concentrations or a higher potential to make someone anaphylaxis?
So as per everything, it depends. So there is, and again, this is pediatric allergy, but there is like a dairy ladder. For the more denatured the protein, sometimes people can tolerate a very denatured form of the protein. So if it's a really super baked product, that is something that perhaps someone can tolerate. But if you're going up towards, you know, like a milkshake, full dairy, that's going to be a problem. But if it's denatured, maybe you can tolerate it. So in its baked form, you can tolerate it. And I was commenting on eggs because the same thing applies for people who are intolerant. Maybe they can tolerate it in baked products, but they can't tolerate it as a whole egg. So the allergies that people develop are to a specific entity. They're to a specific protein. And milk has more than one protein in it, right? So there's whey, there's casein, there's other components of milk that people may have an ability to tolerate one, but not the other. But again, that now you're going into like sort of nuanced testing if you have access to it. And then you want to see to what extent can a child tolerate. This is through graded challenges, right? Like to what extent can you tolerate the particular protein that you seem to be allergic to? And when you find that threshold, you try to maintain some regular consumption of it below that threshold so that you maintain that tolerance.
This is a loaded question. And the question is, do you go there? So you're an expert in allergy and immunology. You really understand anaphylaxis versus atopy. You understand someone who might not like a food versus someone who may be intolerant, right? Lactose intolerance. Now, when I get these requests for parties, I fall back on the fact that, you know, it's my party. I can cry if I want to. If someone's hosting a party, you can do whatever you want. It's up to me as a guest to go or not go. And it's up to me as a guest to adhere to the rules and restrictions, right? If they said it's a party and I want you to paint your kid in blue paint, I don't want to do that because I don't want to bring my kid home and have to bathe them and get paint all over the house. So we're not going to go. But in these cases here, I generally submit. I think it's an interesting request. You know, obviously very different if someone's hosting a party and says, I have a known history of anaphylaxis to food A or B. These are young children. I'd ask that you don't bring that there. Totally get that. But in these other instances, I end up just getting crappy food, right? Because when you look at nut-free, dairy-free foods, you end up getting gummy bears, right? And Sour Kids and just complete crap. But you bring that and you bring it to the party, but I don't even have a conversation. Do you ever think it's appropriate to probe or speak with some of the parents and perhaps there might be a misunderstanding, do a little bit of myth busting, or do you not even bother?
It really depends on, am I going to see these people again and how much do I want to maintain this relationship, right? Or if this is a one-off and I don't know the people very well, I'm not going to probe. I'm not going to go out of my way because what's the point, right? Like, what is the point? Maybe when I'm there, I'll ask, and I often do because I just out of curiosity, you know, tell me what happened or why is this such and such, just out of curiosity. But I try not to go into like a prescriptive, well, you know, that's not really an allergy or that's an intolerance. I don't take that stance because it's super unpleasant. It's sometimes condescending and it's uncalled for. Like, really, why? You know, you're at a fun children's party. I'm not here to preach to you about the differences between an intolerance and an allergy, whatever. But I definitely have had that conversation with people that I do know and events that where it is stated, like there is, please don't bring the following item. Why? You know, like, why not? And you'll usually get it. You'll be like, someone's allergic. And I'll say, whoa, like EpiPen allergic is how I'll frame it, you know, like anaphylaxis allergic. And that usually helps people say, well, oh no, well, not like an EpiPen. They just like really don't like it. They don't feel well when they smell it. So then in my head, I'm like, okay, well, it's an intolerance. They didn't come to see me as a patient. They didn't ask my expert opinion. They're not fishing for education on the subject. So I feel like I have a better understanding of the situation, but I also feel like they don't particularly care what my opinion is. So I'm just going to honor that. It's their party. They can do whatever they want, right? But I'll feel a little bit more comfortable if someone else didn't follow the rules and I see an accidental exposure potentially happening. Maybe I'm a little less worried.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel it's no different than, you know, myself as a specialist in internal medicine. If someone keeps having heart attacks and has, you know, 20 cardiac stents and they keep smoking, unless they ask me, you know, I really hate getting these stents and having heart attacks. What's your opinion? You know, maybe you should look at quitting smoking or getting help to reduce your intake. I'm not going to say it. And I feel the same way. Unless someone's asking me my opinion, I stay away. Sometimes I'll ask some probing questions and just try to understand. But it's more for me to better inform my children because my kids are the one who ask the hard questions, right? Coming home from lunch and dad, you packed this snack today. It actually isn't nut-free. I could have killed someone at school. Yeah. And I'm trying to unpackage and explain that to them. When they go to events and parties, if there is an allergy there, they may have anxieties. And I need to explain that to them. And that's where it gets a little bit challenging. So I don't know if you run into situations where you have to explain to your kids why certain foods are packaged in the lunch bags. And you even explained at the outset of the episode that there's no evidence that restricting the food that we bring into kids' schools has changed the rates of anaphylaxis and childhood death due to food allergy in school. But still, every morning I'm explaining why, you know, you can't have those Reese peanut butter cups in today's lunch, but you can have them when you get home. And how do you navigate those conversations with your kids? And moreover, as somebody who manages a school, how do you decide that?
Well, so I will say, yes, I'm in a very unique position. While I don't manage the school, I'm a co-founder and was board chair and so got to write the policies. So there's some inherent benefits to knowing what I know and being in that position, so that sort of uniquely positioned us into being able to approach things differently at the school. We do not have blanket food bans at the school that my kids go to. We don't have them. We have anaphylaxis action plans, and we are aware, and I shouldn't say we because I don't work at the school, but the staff is aware of every child that's at the school and what they are allergic to. They have the printed out that you can get from the websites, Allergy Canada, get from your doctor, your allergist, like an action plan for what it is, the child's photo, what are you allergic to, what happens, where's the EpiPen stored in the school. And every child who has an identified anaphylaxis has an EpiPen at the school. If they don't have an allergy sort of action plan, they are advised to seek that out through their family physician or to be referred to a specialist to get that for more information. And so there are children at the school who do have dairy allergy, who do have peanut allergy, and those action plans exist for them. And there is also stock epinephrine held at the school, which is not prescribed for the child, but you can go to a pharmacy and just buy an EpiPen, right? So we have that at the school where there's always epinephrine. And then there's anaphylaxis education for the staff at the beginning of every year on how to administer epinephrine, how to identify anaphylaxis, what to do in case someone is accidentally exposed. Everything has to do with risk mitigation. So like I said, there's no food bans, which means that a child can bring a pack of Cheetos into the classroom and eat it at the same time that there is a dairy allergic child sitting in the same classroom, right? The way that we get around that is also by educating the children. So allergy education is part of what they learn. They understand what it means. What is anaphylaxis? What isn't anaphylaxis? What are the foods? They actually have built it into their curriculum. So the kids are aware of what it means and aware of the precautions they need to take to protect each other. So if someone chooses to bring a peanut butter jelly sandwich into school, they know that when they're eating that, they are going to eat at a different table. When they're finished eating it, they're going to wash their hands with warm soapy water really well. They're going to wipe down their table. They're going to clear all of that out of the way. And what we do have is then for unsupervised snack time, we have sent out information for the school to say during recess and unsupervised snack time, don't bring dairy and peanuts because there are children who have anaphylaxis and we can't ensure that the children are going to wash their hands, not smear their food, et cetera, et cetera. So it's risk mitigation. But when it's supervised mealtime, you can bring whatever you want and everyone is educated on how to manage that. And we know where the EpiPens are and we know how to use it. And it actually allows for student agency, right? Because it's a bit of an artificial environment that we're creating for children to completely make these bubble wrapped schools where no allergenic foods are allowed. And then you leave that environment with this expectation that everyone is going to look after your allergy, but they're not. And they're not going to be aware and they're not going to know how to manage it. And at some point, that transition needs to happen where the children feel empowered to manage it, to be aware of it. But then others are also getting educated on how to look after their friends, right? How to be careful, how to be respectful.
The management of allergy. And I think about classic experiences and things I've been told, and I think we've all imagined as healthcare providers. One is, as someone myself, I've actually had anaphylaxis to something. I was on vacation in Brazil. This was in residency with a colleague. And I did the classic, I started to have anaphylaxis symptoms. And that was a good time to leave all of the people and go for a walk alone, right? Because I didn't feel right. You know, it's the classic person at the wedding who started to feel unwell, their breathing was short. So they're going to go outside and catch some air. And then they find them dead outside from anaphylaxis. And then being in situations where I've been with other people who were experiencing allergic reactions, and as medical professionals, especially someone who does critical care, we start looking around for a pen, right? In the event that we got to make a little hole in their neck to breathe through in case their airway swells. So if you're in a situation and you're not a healthcare worker like us, and you see somebody who you feel might be having an anaphylactic reaction, you know, you talked about swelling, you talked about breathing problems, you talked about coughing, you talked about hives, right? Skin changes. Mm-hmm. If you're around someone who has that, what do you do? And if you don't do anything, are all those people going to die because they can't breathe? Or is it a spectrum, the amount of anaphylaxis you have?
Two questions there. Does all anaphylaxis lead to death? The answer is no, but the risk is high, so you don't want to take it. If you see somebody and you're suspicious of anaphylaxis, I mean, that's very, in what scenario is that happening, right? Like, do you know the person and you know they're allergic to something and you're at a buffet, you know, or is it just like a random person on the street who's breaking out into hives with their tongue swelling? Depending on the scenario, right? I mean, safety first, identify it. Do you feel comfortable dealing with it? If you don't know the person, if it's just a random person, you have no idea what's going on. It may or may not be, I mean, call an ambulance, call help, call somebody. But if you're seeing somebody So let's say the scenario, again, going back to the school. So we know that there are children who have anaphylaxis and anaphylactic reactions, possibly to some food. Say it is around a mealtime. And you know the person didn't have it because they're not having it in their lunch kit, but maybe there was some accidental exposure or something. You start seeing these symptoms. You start like, you know, I'm itchy. Something's wrong. There's some tightness in my chest. I may or may not have been exposed. I don't know, but symptoms are starting. What we teach is that if you are suspicious that the person who has known anaphylaxis may have come in contact with that allergen and is exhibiting any symptoms, it's epi first. Epi first, ask questions later. You're not going to sit there and be like, well, what did you consume? Well, who was here before? Well, tell me, how are you feeling now? You know, you're not going to dive into that. You're going to get their EpiPen, administer EpiPen, call 911, you know, and then follow up with the questions after. And in basically in every scenario where a person is carrying an EpiPen for a possible anaphylaxis, if there is a question of, are they or are they not having anaphylaxis? I'm not sure. They're only having one symptom. Maybe it's not bad enough yet, etc. When there's a doubt, when you're not sure, you give the epi first. You always give the epi first. Even when people who have horrible cardiac disease, you know, where epinephrine, like, you don't want to be raising their blood pressure and heart rates dramatically with epinephrine, and you're afraid, should I or shouldn't I? Oh my gosh, what's going to, there is zero contraindication, like the none. You always administer the epinephrine when you're suspicious of an anaphylactic reaction.
What about like Claritin, Reactin, Benadryl? Is there a role for those things or absolutely not?
No, not for anaphylaxis. No, not for anaphylaxis. And the risk for those is that they mask the symptoms. So like I said, these sometimes anaphylactic symptoms, it can evolve slowly. You might just start with a little bit of itching, a couple of hives here and there. And then in a few minutes, you know, something's tickling in my throat. It's a little hard. It feels a little tight to breathe. If you're reaching for an antihistamine, it's going to do a great job of masking some of those symptoms. You're going to feel temporarily relieved, but the reaction that is taking place is going to continue, but now you're masking some of the symptoms. So you're feeling this false sense of security that you've covered your mild allergic reaction. But if you're someone who's at risk of anaphylaxis, you don't ever reach for those first. You reach for your EpiPen first. You can, after you have administered epinephrine, absolutely the antihistamines work for comfort care, right? So you don't, being itchy is uncomfortable. If you still have some of that, you can take some of it on top of it. But if you've administered epinephrine, then you're going to the hospital anyways. So if you're using your EpiPen, you've called an ambulance and you're going to be getting medical care. So that's the advice we give people. When in doubt, use your EpiPen. And if you've used your EpiPen, 911.
Does that EpiPen expire? Like if you leave it out in the sun or, you know, not in a cool, dark place, and you talk about expiration dates, and I know for medications, they're very arbitrary, depends on the temperature, the humidity. Does an EpiPen expire? Like even if someone's having this at home and they don't have their EpiPen, but I have one because I've had anaphylaxis before, yep, but it's expired. Is that a waste of time or should I give it?
No, give it for sure. So they do expire because everything expires, right? Like there's an expiration date stamped on everything, but do they really? I mean, they've looked at this and like the effectiveness does wane over time. The rule of thumb for EpiPens is for the typical EpiPens, like the ones that most people have, the brand EpiPen, there's a little window on the side of it, like a little clear cut square window on the side of the pen where you can actually see inside it. If it's murky, if it's like white, cloudy, murky, sedimented, that one's no good. Go give that back to the pharmacy and get a fresh one for stock. But if you look in that little window and it's clear, you're not seeing anything floating around there, it's not cloudy, it's just a clear liquid, administer it anyways, even if it's 1 year, 2 years expired. I mean, you want to keep these things at room temperature. So yes, don't put it in the fridge. Don't leave it in your car on a super cold day or super hot day. That's going to make it, you know, it's going to denature really, really quickly. But if you have something that's just been sitting in your cupboard for years, even, and it's not murky in the window, administer it. Yeah.
So the take home is if you see something that looks like anaphylaxis, it probably is, and get epinephrine in. The rest doesn't really matter. I was just thinking on the bubble wrapping our schools and really protecting, you know, maybe if all these tech companies who are creating these virtual environments on our headsets and the Vision Pro and the Meta Quest, maybe it's all part of the master plan, right? That all of our future is going to be virtual anyways, and we're not going to be interacting with people. So who cares if we're allergic to everything, right? We're not going to be seeing each other. I hope that's not our future.
That would be awful because we need exposure. We need exposure actually to keep our immune systems healthy. Like we need exposure to each other. We need exposure to pathogens. We need exposure to the environment to maintain a healthy functional immune system. I think that if we're all sitting at home on virtual everything with no contact with the natural environment and other humans and all of our beautiful, nasty pathogens, I shudder to think what our systems are going to do, what novel ways they're going to discover to fight boredom. Like, we might be the sickest people yet in that environment, right? Not the healthiest at all.
And I really like that analogy with the IgE having nothing better to do now that we've gotten rid of parasites, that it starts reacting to foods that we expose. And maybe in the virtual future, we'll all be allergic to our headsets, and then it'll force us to get outside and interact with people. So thank you so much for the insightful and wonderful conversation today. I learned a lot. And I think this provides a nice bridge. I really do want to have you back, because the one thing we didn't touch on is the whole other side of an allergist and immunologist, which is our immune systems. And I think that that whole exposure hypothesis, I know that's where it's going to go. There's a lot to talk about as it pertains to vaccines, to autoimmune diseases, and to the future of humankind in this world. So I'll definitely have you back if you're interested in that.
Yeah, for sure, Mark. That sounds great.
And thank you so much for being a part today.
Thank you. Thank you. This is fun.
I could have kept that conversation going for a few hours. What's crazy is when I invited her to join me in the podcast studio today, the purpose was to cover the entire span of allergy and immunology. Now, we didn't even touch on immunology because there was so much to cover and discuss in the field of allergy. And I think a lot of the things that we discussed today are things that anyone who is a parent of young children has had to digest. I'm sure a lot of people in the listening audience have children who have had some spectrum of allergic reaction, have been to birthday parties, have been to play dates, have been to events whereby they've had to be careful about the foods that they've packed. I know personally, I have some close friends whose children do have anaphylactic reactions to various foods, and it definitely leads to a lot of stress in the parents, right? It's hard to have a child who has an illness. It's hard to have a child who has an allergic reaction or a risk of anaphylaxis. We only want what is best for our children. And a lot of emotions come up in there. And I think back to the emotions that were rife during the COVID pandemic, you know, when we had frontline healthcare workers exposing themselves to this virus, and we had the maskers and the anti-maskers, we had the vaxxers and the anti-vaxxers, and a lot of emotions got into that and got the best of us. And I've also seen quite panicked parents, in fact, you know, have a child who has a history of allergy or a food insensitivity and is quite concerned when they're at an event and they see something out there that might harm their child. I think it's a natural instinct as a parent to want to protect your kids. I'm hopeful that the topics that we covered today will arm everybody with a little bit of knowledge and experience to approach these types of situations, whether it's being invited to a function, just as the function that I described, where I'm being asked to restrict the type of food that I bring, or if you're at a party or a wedding and you see somebody having a reaction that you're concerning is anaphylaxis. Even EpiPens, as a parent of four kids, I have a few EpiPens in the house. I think kid two and kid four, or kid one and kid three have had allergic reactions before. I've had anaphylaxis before, so I have one in the house. But just knowing how to recognize when that EpiPen has expired, if you don't know how to use one but have them in the house, going online and learning how to use an EpiPen, that can definitely be life-saving. Magda talked about how antihistamines, so Benadryl, Reactine, Claritin, that's good for hay fever and that's good for watery eyes when the pollen is rich outside, but it's not going to make a lick of difference when it comes to saving someone's airway if they're having anaphylaxis. But epinephrine, which is the stuff that's inside the EpiPen, can definitely be life-saving. I think it's important to recognize that if you do have that around the house, you should know how to use it. You should make sure that it's still in good working order, because who knows, you might be in a situation where you have to apply that. Hopefully, some of the things that we talked about today will make you mindful of how to navigate some of those situations that you may be in, such as kids' parties, kids' play dates, going to school, even how to manage some of those conversations with your children. I'm really looking forward to having Magda back in the studio down the line to talk about immunology. Lots there to unpackage: vaccines, the safety of vaccines, the expected reactions, autoimmune diseases. Are some autoimmune diseases a disease of the West? You know, in Western world, in North America, they seem to be in higher prevalences than in other parts of the world. How is our lifestyle influencing and changing our immune systems? And what can everybody out there do to protect their immune system and to make sure that it develops properly and does what its intended purpose is? So definitely things to cover the next time Magda is in the studio. But I really wanted to thank her for taking the time to join me today to really unpackage allergies in a way that everyone can understand. As always, a shout out to everyone behind the scenes: Richie in engineering, Cam at production, to the social media people out there helping to make me visible online, to those of you who follow on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, etc. It's been quite the journey. Looking forward to having more interesting guests in the studio. Be sure to share your feedback with me on the website. Let me know what topics you want me to cover and which guests you want me to have in the studio. As always, thanks to all the listeners for taking the time to listen today. See you on the flip side. Thanks for listening to Ditch the Lab Coat with Dr. Bonta, the home of science-based skepticism. Tune in next Wednesday for another healthcare conversation. For more information, please visit labcoat.fm.